In the year 1830, after the formation of Starways Congress, a robot scout ship sent a report by Ansible. The planet it was investigating was well within the parameters for human life. The nearest planet with any kind of population pressure was Bahia. Starways Congress granted them the exploration license. So it was that the first humans to see the new world were Portuguese by language, Brazilian by culture, and Catholic by creed. In the year 1886, they disembarked from their shuttle, crossed themselves, and named the planet Lusitania, the ancient name of Portugal. They set about cataloging the flora and fauna. 5 days later, they realized that the little forest-dwelling animals that they had called porquinhos, piggies, were not animals at all. For the first time since the xenocide of the buggers by the monstrous Ender, humans had found intelligent alien life. The piggies were technologically primitive, but they used tools and built houses and spoke a language. "It is another chance God has given us," declared Arch-Cardinal Pio of Bahia. "We can be redeemed for the destruction of the buggers." The members of Starways Congress worshipped many gods, or none, but they agreed with the Arch-Cardinal. Lusitania would be settled from Bahia, and therefore under Catholic license, as tradition demanded. But the colony could never spread beyond a limited area or exceed a limited population. And it was bound, above all, by one law. The piggies were not to be disturbed.
Fantastic Audio presents Speaker for the Dead by Orson Scott Card.
Chapter 1. Peepo.
Since we are not yet fully comfortable with the idea that people from the next village are as human as ourselves, it is presumptuous in the extreme to suppose we could ever look at sociable, tool-making creatures who arose from other evolutionary paths and see not beasts, but brothers, not rivals, but fellow pilgrims journeying to the shrine of intelligence. Yet that is what I see, or yearn to see. The difference between Raman and Varelza is not in the creature judged, but in the creature judging. When we declare an alien species to be Raman, it does not mean that they have passed a threshold of moral maturity. It means that we have. Demosthenes, Letter to the Framlings.
Ruder was at once the most difficult and the most helpful of the Pequeninos. He was always there whenever Peepo visited their clearing, and did his best to answer the questions Peepo was forbidden by law to come right out and ask. Peepo depended on him. Too much, probably. Yet, though Ruder clowned and played like the irresponsible youngling that he was, he also watched, probed, tested. Peepo always had to beware of the traps that Ruder set for him. A moment ago, Ruder had been shimmying up trees, gripping the bark with only the horny pads on his ankles and inside his thighs. In his hands, he carried two sticks. Father sticks, they were called, which he beat against the tree in a compelling, arrhythmic pattern as he climbed. The noise brought Mandashuva out of the log house. He called to Ruder in the Mayo's language and then in Portuguese. Prabaixo, bicho. Several piggies nearby, hearing his Portuguese wordplay, expressed their appreciation by rubbing their thighs together sharply. It made a hissing noise, and Mandashuva took a little hop in the air in delight at their applause. Ruder, in the meantime, bent over backward until it seemed certain he would fall. Then he flipped off with his hands, did a somersault in the air, and landed on his legs, hopping a few times but not stumbling. "So now you're an acrobat," said Peepo. Ruder swaggered over to him. It was his way of imitating humans. It was all the more effective as ridicule because his flattened, upturned snout looked decidedly porcine. No wonder that off-worlders called them piggies. The earliest visitors to this world had started calling them that in their first reports back in 86, and by the time Lusitania Colony was founded in 1925, The name was indelible. The Xenologers, scattered among the hundred worlds, wrote of them as Lusitanian Aborigines, though Peepo knew perfectly well that this was merely a matter of professional dignity. Except in scholarly papers, Xenologers no doubt called them piggies, too. As for Peepo, he usually called them pequeninos, and they seemed not to object, for now they called themselves little ones. Still, dignity or not, there was no denying it. At moments like this, Rooter looked like a hog on its hind legs. Acrobat, Rooter said, trying out the new word. What I did? You have a word for people who do that? So there are people who do that as their work? Peepo sighed silently, even as he froze his smile in place. The law strictly forbade him to share information about human society, lest it contaminate piggy culture. Yet Rooter played a constant game of squeezing the last drop of implication out of everything Peepo said. This time, though, Peepo had no one to blame but himself, letting out a silly remark that opened unnecessary windows onto human life. Now and then he got so comfortable among the pequeninos that he spoke naturally. Always a danger. I'm not good at this constant game of taking information while trying to give nothing in return. Lebo, my close-mouthed son, already he's better at discretion than I am, and he's only been apprenticed to me... How long since he turned 13? 4 months. I wish I had pads on my legs like yours, said Peepo. The bark on that tree would rip my skin to shreds. That would cause us all to be ashamed. Rooter held still in the expectant posture that Peepo thought of as their way of showing mild anxiety, or perhaps a nonverbal warning to other pequeninos to be cautious. It might also have been a sign of extreme fear, but as far as Peepo knew, he had never seen a pequenino show extreme fear. In any event, Peepo spoke quickly to calm him. Don't worry. I'm too old and soft to climb trees like that. I'll leave it to you younglings. And it worked. Rooter's body at once became mobile again. I like to climb trees. I can see everything. Rooter squatted in front of Peepo and leaned his face in close. Will you bring the beast that runs over the grass without touching the ground? The others don't believe me when I say I saw such a thing. Another trap. What? Peepo. Xenologer, will you humiliate this individual of the community you're studying? Or will you adhere to the rigid law set up by Starway's Congress to govern this encounter? There were few precedents. The only other intelligent aliens that humankind had encountered were the buggers 3,000 years ago. And at the end of it, the buggers were all dead. This time Starway's Congress was making sure that if humanity erred, their errors would be in the opposite direction. Minimal information, minimal contact. Rooter recognized Peepo's hesitation, his careful silence. You never tell us anything, said Rooter. You watch us and study us, but you never let us past your fence and into your village to watch you and study you. Peepo answered as honestly as he could, but it was more important to be careful than to be honest. If you learn so little, and we learn so much, why is it that you speak both Stark and Portuguese, while I'm still struggling with your language? We're smarter. Then Rooter leaned back and spun around on his buttocks, so his back was toward Peepo. Go back behind your fence, he said. Peepo stood at once. Not too far away, Lebo was with three pequeninos, trying to learn how they wove dried merdona vines into thatch. He saw Peepo and in a moment was with his father, ready to go. Peepo led him off without a word. Since the pequeninos were so fluent in human languages, they never discussed what they had learned until they were inside the gate. It took a half hour to get home, and it was raining heavily when they passed through the gate and walked along the face of the hill to the Xenador's station. Xenador? Peepo thought of the word as he looked at the small sign above the door. On it, the word Xenologer was written in Stark. That is what I am, I suppose, thought Peepo, at least to the off-worlders. But the Portuguese title, Zenador, was so much easier to say that on Lusitania hardly anyone said Xenologer, even when speaking Stark. That is how languages change, thought Peepo. If it weren't for the Ansible, providing instantaneous communication among the hundred worlds, we could not possibly maintain a common language. Interstellar travel is far too rare and slow. Stark would splinter into 10,000 dialects within a century. It might be interesting to have the computers run a projection of linguistic changes on Lusitania if Stark were allowed to decay and absorb Portuguese, or vice versa. Father, said Lipo. Only then did Peepo notice that he had stopped 10 meters away from the station. Tangents. The best parts of my intellectual life are tangential, in areas outside my expertise. I suppose because within my area of expertise, the regulations they have placed upon me make it impossible to know or understand anything. The science of xenology insists on more mysteries than Mother Church. His handprint was enough to unlock the door. Peepo knew how the evening would unfold even as he stepped inside to begin. It would take several hours of work at the terminals for them both to report what they had done during today's encounter. Peepo would then read over Lebo's notes, and Lebo would read Peepo's, and when they were satisfied, Peepo would write up a brief summary and then let the computers take it from there, filing the notes and also transmitting them instantly, by Ansible, to the Xenologers and the rest of the Hundred Worlds. More than 1,000 scientists whose whole career is studying the one alien race we know, and except for what little the satellites can discover about this arboreal species, all the information my colleagues have is what Lebo and I send them. This is definitely minimal intervention. But when Peepo got inside the station, he saw at once that it would not be an evening of steady but relaxing work. Dona Cristal was there, dressed in her monastic robes. Was it one of the younger children, in trouble at school? No, no, said Dona Cristal. All your children are doing very well, except this one, who I think is far too young to be out of school and working here, even as an apprentice. Lebo said nothing. A wise decision, thought Peepo. Dona Cristal was a brilliant and engaging, perhaps even beautiful young woman, but she was first and foremost a monk of the order of the Filhos Domenici de Cristo, children of the mind of Christ, and she was not beautiful to behold when she was angry at ignorance and stupidity. It was amazing the number of quite intelligent people whose ignorance and stupidity had melted somewhat in the fire of her scorn. Silence, Lebo. It's a policy that will do you good. I'm not here about any child of yours at all, said Dona Cristal. I'm here about Novinia. Dona Cristal did not have to mention a last name. Everybody knew Novinia. The terrible Descolada had ended only 8 years before. The plague had threatened to wipe out the colony before it had a fair chance to get started. The cure was discovered by Novinia's father and mother, Gusto and Sida, the two xenobiologists. It was a tragic irony that they found the cause of the disease and its treatment too late to save themselves. Theirs was the last Descolada funeral. Peepo clearly remembered the little girl Novinia, standing there, holding Mayor Bosquinha's hand while Bishop Peregrino conducted the funeral mass himself. No, not holding the mayor's hand. The picture came back to his mind, and with it, the way he felt. What does she make of this? He remembered asking himself. It's the funeral of her parents. She's the last survivor in her family. Yet all around her, she can sense the great rejoicing of the people of this colony. Young as she is, does she understand that our joy is the best tribute to her parents? They struggled and succeeded, finding our salvation in the waning days before they died. We're here to celebrate the great gift they gave us. But to you, Novinia, It's the death of your parents, as your brothers died before. 500 dead, and more than 100 masses for the dead here in this colony in the last 6 months, and all of them were held in an atmosphere of fear and grief and despair. Now, when your parents die, the fear and grief and despair are no less for you than ever before. But no one else shares your pain. It is the relief from pain that is foremost in our minds. Watching her, trying to imagine her feelings, he succeeded only in rekindling his own grief at the death of his own Maria, 7 years old, swept away in the wind of death that covered her body in cancerous growth and rampant funguses, the flesh swelling or decaying, a new limb, not arm or leg, growing out of her hip, while the flesh sloughed off her feet and head, bearing the bones, her sweet and beautiful body destroyed before their eyes, while her bright mind was mercilessly alert, able to feel all that happened to her until she cried out to God to let her die. People remembered that, and then remembered her requiem mass, shared with 5 other victims. As he sat, knelt, stood there with his wife and surviving children, he had felt the perfect unity of the people in the cathedral. He knew that his pain was everybody's pain, that through the loss of his eldest daughter, he was bound to his community with the inseparable bonds of grief. And it was a comfort to him. It was something to cling to. That was how such a grief ought to be, a public mourning. Little Novinia had nothing of that. Her pain was, if anything, worse than Pippo's had been. At least Pippo had not been left without any family at all. And he was an adult, not a child, terrified by suddenly losing the foundation of her life. In her grief, she was not drawn more tightly into the community, but rather excluded from it. Today everyone was rejoicing, except her. Today everyone praised her parents. She alone yearned for them, would rather they had never found the cure for others if only they could have remained alive themselves. Her isolation was so acute that Pippo could see it from where he sat. Novinia took her hand away from the mayor as quickly as possible. Her tears dried up as the mass progressed. By the end, she sat in silence, like a prisoner refusing to cooperate with her captors. Pippo's heart broke for her. Yet he knew that even if he tried, he could not conceal his own gladness at the end of the Descolada, his rejoicing that none of his other children would be taken from him. She would see that. His effort to comfort her would be a mockery, would drive her further away. After the mass, she walked in bitter solitude amid the crowds of well-meaning people who cruelly told her that her parents were sure to be saints, sure to sit at the right hand of God. What kind of comfort is that for a child? Pippo whispered aloud to his wife, "She'll never forgive us for today." Forgive? Conceição was not one of those wives who instantly understood her husband's train of thought. We didn't kill her parents. But we're all rejoicing today, aren't we? She'll never forgive us for that. Nonsense. She doesn't understand anyway. She's too young. She understands, Pippo thought. Didn't Maria understand things when she was even younger than Novinia is now? As the years passed, 8 years now, he had seen her from time to time. She was his son Libo's age, and until Libo's 13th birthday, that meant they were in many classes together. He heard her give occasional readings and speeches, along with other children. There was an elegance to her thought, an intensity to her examination of ideas which appealed to him. At the same time, she seemed utterly cold, completely removed from everyone else. Pipo's own boy, Libo, was shy, but even so, he had several friends and had won the affection of his teachers. Novena, though, had no friends at all. No one whose gaze she sought after a moment of triumph. There was no teacher who genuinely liked her because she refused to reciprocate, to respond. "She is emotionally paralyzed," Donna Cristão said once when Pipo asked about her. "There is no reaching her. She swears that she's perfectly happy and doesn't see any need to change." Now, Donna Cristão had come to the Zenador station to talk to Pipo about Novena. Why Pipo? He could guess only one reason for the principal of the school to come to him about this particular orphaned girl. "Am I to believe that in all the years you've had Novena in your school, I'm the only person who asked about her?" "Not the only person," she said. "There was all kinds of interest in her a couple of years ago, when the Pope beatified her parents. Everybody asked then whether the daughter of Gusto and Sida, Os Venerados, had ever noticed any miraculous events associated with her parents, as so many other people had. They actually asked her that. There were rumors, and Bishop Peregrino had to investigate." Donna Cristão got a bit tight-lipped when she spoke of the young spiritual leader of Lusitania Colony. But then it was said that the hierarchy never got along well with the order of the Filhos da Menchi de Cristo. Her answer was instructive. "I can imagine." She said, more or less, that if her parents were actually listening to prayers and had any influence in heaven to get them granted, then why wouldn't they have answered her prayer for them to return from the grave? "That would be a useful miracle," she said, "and there are precedents. If Os Venerados actually had the power to grant miracles, then it must mean they did not love her enough to answer her prayer." She preferred to believe that her parents still loved her and simply did not have the power to act. "A born sophist," said Pipo. "A sophist and an expert in guilt. She told the bishop that if the Pope declared her parents to be venerable, it would be the same as the church saying that her parents hated her. The petition for canonization of her parents was proof that Lusitania despised her. If it was granted, it would be proof that the church itself was despicable." Bishop Peregrino was livid. "I notice he sent in the petition anyway, for the good of the community. And there were all those miracles. Someone touches the shrine and a headache goes away and they cry, 'Milagre, O santos me abençoarum.' Miracle, the saints have blessed me. You know that Holy Rome requires more substantial miracles than that. But it doesn't matter. The Pope graciously allowed us to call our little town Milagre. And now I imagine that every time someone says that name, Novena burns a little hotter with her secret rage. Or colder. One never knows what temperature that sort of thing will take. Anyway, Pipo, you aren't the only one who ever asked about her. But you're the only one who ever asked about her for her own sake, and not because of her blessed parents." It was a sad thought that, except for the Filhos, who ran the schools of Lusitania, there had been no concern for the girl except the slender shards of attention Pipo had spared for her over the years. "She has one friend," said Libo. Pipo had forgotten that his son was there. Libo was so quiet that he was easy to overlook. Donna Cristão also seemed startled. "Libo," she said, "I think we were indiscreet talking about one of your schoolmates like this." "I'm apprentice Zenador now," Libo reminded her. "It meant he wasn't in school." "Who is your friend?" asked Pipo. "Marcão." "Marcos Ribeira," Donna Cristão explained. "The tall boy." Yes, the one who's built like a cabra." "He is strong," said Donna Cristão. "But I've never noticed any friendship between them. Once when Marcão was accused of something, and she happened to see it, she spoke for him. You put a generous interpretation on it, Libo, said Donna Cristão. I think it is more accurate to say she spoke against the boys who actually did it and were trying to put the blame on him. Marcão doesn't see it that way, said Libo. I noticed a couple of times the way he watches her. It isn't much, but there is somebody who likes her. Do you like her? Asked Pipo. Libo paused for a moment in silence. Pipo knew what it meant. He was examining himself to find an answer. Not the answer that he thought would be most likely to bring him adult favor, and not the answer that would provoke their ire, the two kinds of deception that most children his age delighted in. He was examining himself to discover the truth. I think, Libo said, that I understood that she didn't want to be liked, as if she were a visitor who expected to go back home any day. Donna Cristão nodded gravely. Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly the way she seems. But now, Libo, we must end our indiscretion by asking you to leave us while we... He was gone before she finished her sentence. With a quick nod of his head, a half-smile that said, yes, I understand, and a deftness of movement that made his exit more eloquent proof of his discretion than if he had argued to stay. By this, Pipo knew that Libo was annoyed at being asked to leave. He had a knack for making adults feel vaguely immature by comparison to him. Pipo, said the principal, she has petitioned for an early examination as xenobiologist to take her parents' place. Pipo raised an eyebrow. She claims that she has been studying the field intensely since she was a little child, that she's ready to begin the work right now, without apprenticeship. She's 13, isn't she? There are precedents. Many have taken such tests early. One even passed it younger than her. It was 2,000 years ago, but it was allowed. Bishop Peregrino is against it, of course, but Mayor Bosquinha, bless her practical heart, has pointed out that Lusitania needs a xenobiologist quite badly. We need to be about the business of developing new strains of plant life so we can get some decent variety in our diet and much better harvests from Lusitanian soil. In her words, I don't care if it's an infant. We need a xenobiologist. And you want me to supervise her examination, if you would be so kind? I'll be glad to. I told them you would. I confess I have an ulterior motive. Oh? I should have done more for the girl. I'd like to see if it isn't too late to begin. Donna Cristão laughed a bit. Oh, people, I'd be glad for you to try. But do believe me, my dear friend, touching her heart is like bathing in ice. I imagine it feels like bathing in ice to the person touching her. But how does it feel to her, cold as she is? It must surely burn like fire. Such a poet, said Donna Cristão. There was no irony in her voice. She meant it. Do the piggies understand that we've sent our very best as our ambassador? I try to tell them, but they're skeptical. I'll send her to you tomorrow. I warn you, she'll expect to take the examinations cold, and she'll resist any attempt on your part to pre-examine her. Pipo smiled. I'm far more worried about what will happen after she takes the test. If she fails, then she'll have very bad problems. And if she passes, then my problems will begin. Why? Libo will be after me to let him examine early for Xenodor. And if he did that, there'd be no reason for me not to go home, curl up, and die. Such a romantic fool you are, Pipo. If there's any man in Milagre who's capable of accepting his 13-year-old son as a colleague, it's you. After she left, Pipo and Libo worked together as usual, recording the day's events with the Pequeninos. Pipo compared Libo's work his way of thinking, his insights, his attitudes, with those of the graduate students he had known in university before joining the Lusitania colony. He might be small, and there might be a lot of theory and knowledge for him yet to learn, but he was already a true scientist in his method, and a humanist at heart. By the time the evening's work was done and they walked home together by the light of Lusitania's large and dazzling moon, Pipo had decided that Libo already deserved to be treated as a colleague, whether he took the examination or not. The tests couldn't measure the things that really counted anyway. And whether she liked it or not, Pipo intended to find out if Novinia had the unmeasurable qualities of a scientist. If she didn't, then he'd see to it she didn't take the test, regardless of how many facts she had memorized.
Pipo meant to be difficult. Novinia knew how adults acted when they planned not to do things her way, but didn't want a fight or even any nastiness. Of course, you can take the test, but there's no reason to rush into it. Let's take some time. Let me make sure you'll be successful on the first attempt. Novinia didn't want to wait. Novinia was ready. I'll jump through any hoops you want, she said. His face went cold. Their faces always did. That was all right. Coldness was all right. She could freeze them to death. I don't want you to jump through hoops, he said. The only thing I ask is that you line them up all in a row so I can jump through them quickly. I don't want to be put off for days and days. He looked thoughtful for a moment. You're in such a hurry. I'm ready. The Starways code allows me to challenge the test at any time. It's between me and the Starways Congress, and I can't find anywhere that it says a Xenologer can try to second-guess the Interplanetary Examinations Board. Then you haven't read carefully. The only thing I need to take the test before I'm 16 is the authorization of my legal guardian. I don't have a legal guardian. On the contrary, said Pipo. Mère Bosquigna was your legal guardian from the day of your parents' death, and she agreed I could take the test, provided you came to me. Novinia saw the intense look in his eyes. She didn't know Pipo, so she thought it was the look she had seen in so many eyes, the desire to dominate, to rule her, the desire to cut through her determination and break her independence, the desire to make her submit. From ice to fire in an instant. What do you know about xenobiology? You only go out and talk to the piggies. You don't even begin to understand the workings of genes. Who are you to judge me? Lusitania needs a xenobiologist, and they've been without one for 8 years. And you want to make them wait even longer just so you can be in control. To her surprise, he didn't become flustered. Didn't retreat, nor did he get angry in return. It was as if she hadn't spoken. I see, he said quietly. It's because of your great love of the people of Lusitania that you wish to become xenobiologist. Seeing the public need, you sacrificed and prepared yourself to enter early into a lifetime of altruistic service. It sounded absurd hearing him say it like that, and it wasn't at all what she felt. Isn't that a good enough reason? If it were true, it would be good enough. Are you calling me a liar? Your own words called you a liar. You spoke of how much they, the people of Lusitania, need you. But you live among us. You've lived among us all your life. Ready to sacrifice for us, and yet you don't feel yourself to be part of this community. So he wasn't like the adults who always believed lies, as long as they made her seem to be the child they wanted her to be. Why should I feel like part of the community? I'm not. He nodded gravely, as if considering her answer. What community are you a part of? The only other communities on Lusitania are the piggies, and you haven't seen me out there with the tree worshippers. There are many other communities on Lusitania. For instance, you're a student. There's a community of students. Not for me. I know. You have no friends. You have no intimate associates. You go to Mass, but you never go to confession. You are so completely detached that, as far as possible, you don't touch the life of this colony. You don't touch the life of the human race at any point. From all the evidence, you live in complete isolation. Lavinia wasn't prepared for this. He was naming the underlying pain of her life, and she didn't have a strategy devised to cope with it. If I do, it isn't my fault. I know that. I know where it began, and I know whose fault it was that it continues to this day. Mine. Mine. And everyone else's. But mine most of all. Because I knew what was happening to you, and I did nothing at all. Until today. And today you're going to keep me from the one thing that matters to me in my life? Thanks so much for your compassion. Again he nodded solemnly, as if he were accepting and acknowledging her ironic gratitude. In one sense, Novinia, it doesn't matter that it isn't your fault, because the town of Milagre is a community, and whether it has treated you badly or not, it must still act as all communities do, to provide the greatest possible happiness for all its members. Which means everybody on Lusitania except me. Me and the piggies. The xenobiologist is very important to a colony, especially one like this. Surrounded by a fence that forever limits our growth, our xenobiologist must find ways to grow more protein and carbohydrate per hectare, which means genetically altering the earthborn corn and potatoes to make maximum use of the nutrients available in the Lusitanian environment. Do you think I'm planning to take the examination without knowing what my life's work would be? Your life's work. To devote yourself to improving the lives of people you despise? Now Novinia saw the trap that he had laid for her. Too late. It had sprung. So you think that a xenobiologist can't do her work unless she loves the people who use the things she makes?
I don't care whether you love us or not. What I have to know is what you really want. Why you're so passionate to do this.
Basic psychology. My parents died in this work, and so I'm trying to step into their role.
Maybe. And maybe not. What I want to know, Novinia, what I must know before I'll let you take the test, is what community you do belong to.
You said it yourself. I don't belong to any.
Impossible. Every person is defined by the communities she belongs to and the ones she doesn't belong to. I am this and this and this, but definitely not that and that and that. All your definitions are negative. I could make an infinite list of the things you are not. But a person who really believes she doesn't belong to any community at all invariably kills herself, either by killing her body or by giving up her identity and going mad.
That's me. Insane to the root.
Not insane. Driven by a sense of purpose that is frightening. If you take this test, you'll pass it. But before I let you take it, I have to know. Who will you become when you pass? What do you believe in? What are you part of? What do you care about? What do you love?
Nobody in this or any other world.
I don't believe you.
I've never known a good man or woman in the world except my parents, and they're dead. And even they... Nobody understands anything.
You...
I'm part of anything, aren't I? But nobody understands anybody, not even you. Pretending to be so wise and compassionate. But you're only getting me to cry like this because you have the power to stop me from doing what I want to do.
And it isn't xenobiology.
Yes, it is. Well, that's part of it anyway.
And what's the rest of it?
What you are. What you do. Only you're doing it all wrong, and you're doing it stupidly.
Xenobiologist and xenologer.
They made a stupid mistake when they created a new science to study the piggies. There were a bunch of tired old anthropologists who put on new hats and called themselves xenologers. But you can't understand the piggies just by watching the way they behave. They came out of a different evolution. You have to understand their genes, what's going on inside their cells, and the other animals' cells too. Because they can't be studied by themselves, nothing lives in isolation.
Don't lecture me, thought Pipo. Tell me what you feel. And to provoke her to be more emotional, he whispered, "Except you." It worked. From cold and contemptuous, she became hot and defensive. "You'll never understand them, but I will." "Why do you care about them? What are the piggies to you?" "You'd never understand. You're a good Catholic." She said the word with contempt. "It's a book that's on the index." Pipo's face glowed with sudden understanding. The hive queen and the hegemon. He lived 3,000 years ago, whoever he was. The one who called himself the speaker for the dead. But he understood the buggers. We wiped them all out. The only other alien race we ever knew. We killed them all. But he understood. And you want to write the story of the Pequeninos the way the original speaker wrote of the buggers. The way you say it, you make it sound as easy as doing a scholarly paper. You don't know what it was like to write the Hive Queen and the Hegemon. How much agony it was for him to imagine himself inside an alien mind and come out of it filled with love for the great creature we destroyed. He lived at the same time as the worst human being who ever lived, Ender, the Xenocide, who destroyed the buggers. And he did his best to undo what Ender did. The speaker for the dead tried to raise the dead, but he couldn't. But he did. He made them live again. You'd know it if you had read the book. I don't know about Jesus. I listened to Bishop Peregrino, and I don't think there's any power in their priesthood to turn wafers into flesh or forgive a milligram of guilt. But the speaker for the dead brought the Hive Queen back to life. Then where is she? In here. In me. He nodded. And someone else is in you. The speaker for the dead. That's who you want to be. It's the only true story I ever heard, she said. The only one I care about. Is that what you wanted to hear? That I'm a heretic? And my whole life's work is going to be adding another book to the index of truths that good Catholics are forbidden to read? What I wanted to hear, said Pipo softly, was the name of what you are instead of the name of all the things that you are not. What you are is the Hive Queen. What you are is the speaker for the dead. It's a very small community. Small in numbers, but a great-hearted one. So you chose not to be part of the bands of children who group together for the sole purpose of excluding others. And people look at you and say, poor girl, she's so isolated. But you know a secret. You know who you really are. You are the one human being who is capable of understanding the alien mind, because you are the alien mind. You know what it is to be unhuman because there's never been any human group that gave you credentials as a bona fide Homo sapiens. Now you say, I'm not even human. You made me cry like a little girl because you wouldn't let me take the test. You made me humiliate myself, and now you say I'm unhuman? You can take the test. The words hung in the air.
When?
She whispered. Tonight? Tomorrow? Begin when you like. I'll stop my work to take you through the tests as quickly as you like.
Thank you. Thank you. I
become the speaker for the dead. I'll help you all I can. The law forbids me to take anyone but my apprentice, my son Lebo, out to meet the Pecaninos. But we'll open our notes to you. Everything we learn, we'll show you. All our guesses and speculation. In return, you also show us all your work. What you find out about the genetic patterns of this world that might help us understand the Pecaninos. And when we've learned enough, together, you can write your book. You can become the speaker. But this time, not the speaker for the dead. The Pecaninos aren't dead. In spite of herself, she smiled. The speaker for the living. I've read The Hive Queen and the Hegemon, too, he said. I can't think of a better place for you to find your name. But she did not trust him yet, did not believe what he seemed to be promising. I want to come here often, all the time. We lock it up when we go home to bed. But all the rest of the time, you'll get tired of me. You'll tell me to go away. You'll keep secrets from me. You'll tell me to be quiet and not mention my ideas. We've only just become friends. And already you think I'm such a liar and cheat, such an impatient oaf. But you will. Everyone does. They all wish I'd go away. Peepo shrugged. So? Sometime or other everybody wishes everybody would go away. Sometimes I wish you would go away. What I'm telling you now is that even at those times, even if I tell you to go away, you don't have to go away. It was the most bafflingly perfect thing that anyone had ever said to her.
That's crazy.
Only one thing. Promise me you'll never try to go out to the Pecaninos. Because I can never let you do that. And if somehow you do it anyway, Starway's Congress would close down all our work here, forbid any contact with them. Do you promise me? Or everything? My work, your work, it will all be undone.
I promise.
When will you take the test?
Now. Can I begin it now?
He laughed gently, then reached out a hand and, without looking, touched the terminal. It came to life, the first genetic model was appearing in the air above the terminal.
You had the examination ready, she said.
You were all set to go. You knew that you'd let me do it all along. He shook his head. I hoped. I believed in you. I wanted to help you do what you dreamed of doing. As long as it was something good. She would not have been Novenia if she hadn't found one more poisonous thing to say.
I see. You are the judge of dreams.
Perhaps he didn't know it was an insult. He only smiled and said, faith, hope, and love. These three. But the greatest of these is love.
You don't love me, she said.
Ah, he said, I am the judge of dreams, and you are the judge of love. Well, I find you guilty of dreaming good dreams and sentence you to a lifetime of working and suffering for the sake of your dreams. I only hope that someday you won't declare me innocent of the crime of loving you. He grew reflective for a moment. I lost the daughter in the Descolada.
Maria. She would have been only a few years older than you.
And I remind you of her. I was thinking that she would have been nothing at all like you. She began the test. It took 3 days. She passed it with a score a good deal higher than many a graduate student. In retrospect, however, she would not remember the test because it was the beginning of her career, the end of her childhood, the confirmation of her vocation for her life's work. She would remember the test because it was the beginning of her time in Pippo's station, where Pippo and Libo and Novigna together formed the first community she belonged to since her parents were put into the earth. It was not easy, especially at the beginning. Novigna did not instantly shed her habit of cold confrontation. Pippo understood it, was prepared to bend with her verbal blows. It was much more of a challenge for Libo. The Xenodor's station had been a place where he and his father could be alone together. Now, without anyone asking his consent, a third person had been added. A cold and demanding person who spoke to him as if he were a child, even though they were the same age. It galled him that she was a full-fledged xenobiologist with all the adult status that that implied when he was still an apprentice. But he tried to bear it patiently. He was naturally calm, and quiet adhered to him. He was not prone to taking umbrage openly. But Pippo knew his son, and saw him burn. After a while, even Novigna, insensitive as she was, began to realize that she was provoking Libo more than any normal young man could possibly endure. But instead of easing up on him, she began to regard it as a challenge. How could she force some response from this unnaturally calm, gentle-spirited, beautiful boy? "You mean you've been working all these years," she said one day, "and you don't even know how the piggies reproduce? How do you know they're all males?" Libo answered softly. "We explained male and female to them as they learned our languages. They chose to call themselves males and referred to the ones we've never seen, as females. But for all you know, they reproduce by budding or mitosis." Her tone was contemptuous, and Libo did not answer quickly. Pippo imagined he could hear his son's thoughts, carefully rephrasing his answer until it was gentle and safe. "I wish our work were more like physical anthropology," he said. "Then we would be more prepared to apply your research into Lusitania's subcellular life patterns to what we learn about the Pecaninos." Novigna looked horrified. "You mean you don't even take tissue samples?" Libo blushed slightly, but his voice was still calm when he answered. The boy would have been like this under questioning by the Inquisition, Pippo thought. "It is foolish, I guess," said Libo. "But we're afraid the Pecaninos would wonder why we took pieces of their bodies. If one of them took sick by chance afterward, would they think we caused the illness? What if you took something they shed naturally? You can learn a lot from hair." Libo nodded. Pippo, watching from his terminal on the other side of the room, recognized the gesture. Libo had learned it from his father. "Many primitive tribes of Earth believed that sheddings from their bodies contained some of their life and strength. What if the piggies thought we were doing magic against them? Don't you know their language? I thought some of them spoke Stark, too." She made no effort to hide her disdain. "Can't you explain what the samples are for?" "You're right," he said quietly. "But if we explained what we'd use the tissue samples for, we might accidentally teach them concepts of biological science 1,000 years before they would naturally have reached that point. That's why the law forbids us to explain things like that." Finally, Novigna was abashed. "I didn't realize how tightly you were bound by the doctrine of minimal intervention." Pippo was glad to hear her retreat from her arrogance, but if anything, her humility was worse. The child was so isolated from human contact that she spoke like an excessively formal science book. Pippo wondered if it was already too late to teach her how to be a human being. It wasn't. Once she realized that they were excellent at their science and that she knew almost nothing of it, she dropped her aggressive stance and went almost to the opposite extreme. For weeks, she spoke to Pipo and Lebo only rarely. Instead, she studied their reports, trying to grasp the purpose behind what they were doing. Now and then, she had a question and asked. They answered politely and thoroughly. Politeness gradually gave way to familiarity. Pipo and Lebo began to converse openly in front of her, airing their speculations about why the Pequeninos had developed some of their strange behaviors, what meaning lay behind some of their odd statements, why they remained so maddeningly impenetrable. And since the study of Pequeninos was a very new branch of science, it didn't take long for Novenia to be expert enough, even at second hand, to offer some hypotheses. "After all," said Pipo, encouraging her, "we're all blind together." Pipo had foreseen what happened next. Lebo's carefully cultivated patience had made him seem cold and reserved to others of his age, when Pipo could prevail on him even to attempt to socialize. Novenia's isolation was more flamboyant, but no more thorough. Now, however, their common interest in the Pequeninos drew them close. Who else could they talk to, when no one but Pipo could even understand their conversations? They relaxed together, laughed themselves to tears over jokes that could not possibly amuse any other Luso. Just as the piggies seemed to name every tree in the forest, Lebo playfully named all the furniture in the Zenador station, and periodically announced that certain items were in a bad mood and shouldn't be disturbed. "Don't sit on chair. It's her time of the month again." They had never seen a Pequenino female, and the males always seemed to refer to them with almost religious reverence. Novenia wrote a series of mock reports on an imaginary Pequenino woman called Reverend Mother, who was hilariously bitchy and demanding. It was not all laughter. There were problems, worries, and once a time of real fear that they might have done exactly what the Starways Congress had tried so hard to prevent, make radical changes in Pequenino society. It began with Ruder, of course. Ruder, who persisted in asking challenging, impossible questions like, "If you have no other city of humans, how can you go to war? There's no honor for you in killing little ones." People babbled something about how humans would never kill Pequeninos, little ones. But he knew that this wasn't the question Ruder was really asking. Pipo had known for years that the Pequeninos knew the concept of war, but for days after that, Lebo and Novenia argued heatedly about whether Ruder's question proved that the piggies regarded war as desirable or merely unavoidable. There were other bits of information from Ruder, some important, some not, and many whose importance was impossible to judge. In a way, Ruder himself was proof of the wisdom of the policy that forbade the xenologers to ask questions that would reveal human expectations, and therefore, human practices. Ruder's questions often gave them more answers than they got from his answers to their own questions. The last information Ruder gave them, though, was not in a question. It was a guess, spoken to Lebo privately when Pipo was off with some of the others examining the way they built their log house. I know, said Ruder. "I know why Pipo is still alive. Your women are too stupid to know that he is wise." Lebo struggled to make sense of this seeming non sequitur. What did Ruder think, that if human women were smarter, they would kill Pipo? The talk of killing was disturbing. This was obviously an important matter, and Lebo did not know how to handle it alone. Yet he couldn't call Pipo to help, since Ruder obviously wanted to discuss it where Pipo couldn't hear. When Lebo didn't answer, Ruder persisted. "Your women, they are weak and stupid. I told the others this, and they said I could ask you. Your women don't see Pipo's wisdom. Is this true?" Ruder seemed very agitated. He was breathing heavily, and he kept pulling hairs from his arms, 4 and 5 at a time. Lebo had to answer somehow. "Most women don't know him," he said. "Then how will they know if he should die?" asked Reuter. Then suddenly he went very still and spoke very loudly. "You are Cabras." Only then did Pipo come into view, wondering what the shouting was about. He saw at once that Lebo was desperately out of his depth. Yet Pipo had no notion what the conversation was even about. How could he help? All he knew was that Reuter was saying humans, or at least Pipo and Lebo, were somehow like the large beasts that grazed in herds on the prairie. Pipo couldn't even tell if Reuter was angry or happy. "You are Cabras. You decide." He pointed at Lebo and then at Pipo. "Your women don't choose your honor. You do. Just like in battle, but all the time." Pipo had no idea what Reuter was talking about, but he could see that all the pequeninos were motionless as stumps, waiting for him, or Lebo, to answer. It was plain Lebo was too frightened by Reuter's strange behavior to dare any response at all. In this case, Pipo could see no point but to tell the truth. It was, after all, a relatively obvious and trivial bit of information about human society. It was against the rules that the Starways Congress had established for him, but failing to answer would be even more damaging. And so, Pipo went ahead. "Women and men decide together, or they decide for themselves," said Pipo. "One doesn't decide for the other." It was apparently what all the piggies had been waiting for. "Cabras," they said, over and over. They ran to Reuter, hooting and whistling. They picked him up and rushed him off into the woods. Pipo tried to follow, but two of the piggies stopped him and shook their heads. It was a human gesture they had learned long before, but it held stronger meaning for the pequeninos. It was absolutely forbidden for Pipo to follow. They were going to the women, and that was the one place the pequeninos had told them they could never go. On the way home, Lebo reported how the difficulty began. "Do you know what Reuter said? He said our women were weak and stupid." "That's because he's never met Mayor Bosquinha. Or your mother, for that matter." Lebo laughed, because his mother, Conceição, ruled the archives as if it were an ancient Estação in the wild motto. If you entered her domain, you were utterly subject to her law. As he laughed, he felt something slip away, some idea that was important. What were we talking about? The conversation went on. Lebo had forgotten, and soon he even forgot that he had forgotten. That night they heard the drumming sound that Pipo and Lebo believed was part of some sort of celebration. It didn't happen all that often, like beating on great drums with heavy sticks. Tonight, though, the celebration seemed to go on forever. Pipo and Lebo speculated that perhaps the human example of sexual equality had somehow given the male pequeninos some hope of liberation. "I think this may qualify as a serious modification of pequenino behavior," Pipo said gravely. "If we find that we've caused real change, I'm going to have to report it, and Congress will probably direct that human contact with pequeninos be cut off for a while. Years, perhaps." It was a sobering thought that doing their job faithfully might lead Starways Congress to forbid them to do their job at all. In the morning, Novinha walked with them to the gate in the high fence that separated the human city from the slopes leading up to the forest hills where the piggies lived. Because Pipo and Lebo were still trying to reassure each other that neither of them could have done any differently, Novinha walked on ahead and got to the gate first. When the others arrived, she pointed to a patch of freshly cleared red earth only 30 meters or so up the hill from the gate. "That's new," she said, "and there's something in it." Pipo opened the gate, and Lebo, being younger, ran on ahead to investigate. He stopped at the edge of the cleared patch and went completely rigid, staring down at whatever lay there. Pipo, seeing him, also stopped, and Novenia, suddenly frightened for Lebo, ignored the regulation and ran through the gate. Lebo's head rocked backward, and he dropped to his knees. He clutched his tight, curled hair and cried out in terrible remorse. Reuter lay spread-eagled in the cleared dirt. He had been eviscerated, and not carelessly. Each organ had been cleanly separated, and the strands and filaments of his limbs had also been pulled out and spread in a symmetrical pattern on the drying soil. Everything still had some connection to the body. Nothing had been completely severed. Lebo's agonized crying was almost hysterical. Novenia knelt by him and held him, rocked him, tried to soothe him. Pipo methodically took out his small camera and took pictures from every angle so the computer could analyze it in detail later. "He was still alive when they did this," Lebo said, when he had calmed enough to speak. Even so, he had to say the words slowly, carefully, as if he were a foreigner just learning to speak. "There's so much blood on the ground, spattered so far. His heart had to be beating when they opened him up." "We'll discuss it later," said Pipo. Now the thing Lebo had forgotten yesterday came back to him with cruel clarity. "It's what Reuter said about the women. They decide when the men should die. He told me that, and I..." He stopped himself. Of course he did nothing. The law required him to do nothing. And at that moment, he decided that he hated the law. If the law meant allowing this to be done to Reuter, then the law had no understanding. Reuter was a person. You don't stand by and let this happen to a person just because you're studying him. "They didn't dishonor him," said Novenia. "If there's one thing that's certain, it's the love that they have for trees. See?" Out of the center of his chest cavity, which was otherwise empty now, a very small seedling sprouted. "They planted a tree to mark his burial spot." "Now we know why they name all their trees," said Lebo bitterly. "They planted them as grave markers for the piggies they tortured to death." "This is a very large forest," Pipo said calmly. "Please confine your hypotheses to what is at least remotely possible." They were calmed by his quiet, reasoned tone, his insistence that even now they behave as scientists. "What should we do?" asked Novenia. "We should get you back inside the perimeter immediately," said Pipo. "It's forbidden for you to come out here."
"But I meant, with the body, what should we do?"
"Nothing," said Pipo.
"The Pecaninos have done what Pecaninos do, for whatever reason Pecaninos do it."
He helped Lebo to his feet. Lebo had trouble standing for a moment. He leaned on both of them for his first few steps.
"What did I say?"
he whispered.
"I don't even know what it is I said that killed him."
"It wasn't you," said Pipo. "It was me."
"What, do you think you own them?" demanded Novenia. "Do you think their world revolves around you?"
"As you said, the piggies did it for whatever reason they have. It's plain enough this isn't the first time."
They were too deft at the vivisection for this to be the first time. Pipo took it with black humor.
"We're losing our wits, Lebo. Novenia isn't supposed to know anything about xenology." "You're right," said Lebo. "Whatever may have triggered this, it's something they've done before. A custom."
He was trying to sound calm.
"But that's even worse, isn't it?" said Novenia. "It's their custom to gut each other alive."
She looked at the other trees of the forest that began at the top of the hill and wondered how many of them were rooted in blood. Pipo sent his report on the Ansible, and the computer didn't give him any trouble about the priority level. He left it up to the Oversight Committee to decide whether contact with the piggies should be stopped. The committee could not identify any fatal error. It is impossible to conceal the relationship between our sexes, since someday a woman may be Xenologer, said the report. And we can find no point at which you did not act reasonably and prudently. Our tentative conclusion is that you were unwitting participants in some sort of power struggle, which was decided against Reuter, and that you should continue your contact with all reasonable prudence. It was complete vindication, but it still wasn't easy to take. Lebo had grown up knowing the piggies, or at least hearing about them from his father. He knew Reuter better than he knew any human being besides his family in Novenia. It took days for Lebo to come back to the Xenodorus station, weeks before he would go back out into the forest. The piggies gave no sign that anything had changed. If anything, they were more open and friendly than before. No one ever spoke of Reuter, least of all Peepo and Lebo. There were changes on the human side, however. Peepo and Lebo never got more than a few steps away from each other when they were among them. The pain and remorse of that day drew Lebo and Novenia to rely on each other even more, as though darkness bound them closer than light. The piggies now seemed dangerous and uncertain, just as human company had always been. And between Peepo and Lebo there now hung the question of who was at fault, no matter how often each tried to reassure the other. So the only good and reliable thing in Lebo's life was Novenia. And in Novenia's life, Lebo. Even though Lebo had a mother and siblings, and Peepo and Lebo always went home to them, Novenia and Lebo behaved as if the Xenador station were an island, with Peepo a loving but ever-remote Prospero. Peepo wondered, are the Pecaninos like Ariel, leading the young lovers to happiness? Or are they little Calibans, scarcely under control and chafing to do murder? After a few months, Reuter's death faded into memory, and their laughter returned, though perhaps it was not as carefree as before. By the time they were 17, Lebo and Novenia were so sure of each other that they routinely talked of what they would do together 5, 10, 20 years later. Peepo never bothered to ask them about their marriage plans. After all, he thought, they studied biology from morning to night. Eventually, it would occur to them to explore stable and socially acceptable reproductive strategies. In the meantime, it was enough that they puzzled endlessly over when and how the Pecaninos mated, considering that the males had no discernible reproductive organ. Their speculations on how the Pecaninos combined genetic material invariably ended in jokes so lewd that it took all of Peepo's self-control to pretend not to find them amusing. So the Xenodorus station for those few short years was a place of true companionship for two brilliant young people who otherwise would have been condemned to cold solitude. It did not occur to any of them that the idyll would end abruptly and forever, and under circumstances that would send a tremor throughout the 100 worlds.
It was all so simple, so commonplace. Novenia was analyzing the genetic structure of the fly-infested reeds along the river and realized that the same subcellular body that had caused the Descalada was present in the cells of the reed. She brought several other cell structures into the air over the computer terminal and rotated them. They all contained the Descalada agent. She called to Peepo, who was running through transcriptions of yesterday's visit to the Pecaninos. The computer ran comparisons of every cell she had samples of. Regardless of cell function, regardless of the species it was taken from, every alien cell contained the Descolada body, and the computer declared them absolutely identical in chemical proportions. Novenia expected Peepo to nod, tell her it looked interesting, maybe come up with a hypothesis. Instead, he sat down and ran the same test over asking her questions about how the computer comparison operated and then what the Descolada body actually did. Mother and father never figured out what triggered it, but the Descolada body releases this little protein, well, pseudoprotein, I suppose, and it attacks the genetic molecules, starting at one end and unzipping the two strands of the molecule right down the middle. That's why they call it the Descolador. It unglues the DNA in humans, too. Show me what it does in alien cells. Novinia put the simulation in motion. No, not just the genetic molecule, the whole environment of the cell. It's just in the nucleus, she said. She widened the field to include more variables. The computer took it more slowly, since it was considering millions of random arrangements of nuclear material every second. In the reed cell, as a genetic molecule came unglued, several large ambient proteins affixed themselves to the open strands. In humans, the DNA tries to recombine, but random proteins insert themselves so that cell after cell goes crazy. Sometimes they go into mitosis like cancer, and sometimes they die. What's most important is that in humans, the Descolada bodies themselves reproduce like crazy, passing from cell to cell. Of course, every alien creature already has them. But Pippo wasn't interested in what she said. When the Descolador had finished with the genetic molecules of the reed, he looked from one cell to another. It's not just significant. It's the same, he said. It's the same thing. Novinia didn't see at once what he had noticed. What was the same as what? Nor did she have time to ask. Pippo was already out of the chair, grabbing his coat, heading for the door. It was drizzling outside. Pippo paused only to call out to her, Tell Libo not to bother coming. Just show him that simulation and see if he can figure it out before I get back. He'll know. It's the answer to the big one. The answer to everything. Tell me. He laughed. Don't cheat. Libo will tell you, if you can't see it. Where are you going? To ask the Pecaninos if I'm right, of course. But I know I am, even if they lie about it. If I'm not back in an hour, I slipped in the rain and broke my leg.
Libo did not get to see the simulations. The meeting of the planning committee went way over time in an argument about extending the cattle range, and after the meeting, Libo still had to pick up the week's groceries. By the time he got back, Pippo had been out for 4 hours. It was getting on toward dark, and the drizzle was turning to snow. They went out at once to look for him, afraid that it might take hours to find him in the woods. They found him all too soon. His body was already cooling in the snow. The piggies hadn't even planted a tree in him. Chapter 2. Trondheim. I'm deeply sorry that I could not act upon your request for more detail concerning the courtship and marriage customs of the Aboriginal Lusitanians. This must be causing you unimaginable distress, or else you would never have petitioned the Xenological Society to censure me for failure to cooperate with your researches. When would-be xenologists complain that I am not getting the right sort of data from my observations of the Pecaninos, I always urge them to reread the limitations placed upon me by law. I am permitted to bring no more than one assistant on field visits. I may not ask questions that might reveal human expectations, lest they try to imitate us. I may not volunteer information to elicit a parallel response. I may not stay with them more than 4 hours at a time. Except for my clothing, I may not use any products of technology in their presence, which includes cameras, recorders, computers, or even a manufactured pen to write on manufactured paper. I may not even observe them unawares. In short, I cannot tell you how the Pecaninos reproduce because they have chosen not to do it in front of me. Of course, your research is crippled. Of course our conclusions about the Pecaninos are absurd. If we had to observe your university under the same limitations that bind us in our observation of the Lusitanian Aborigines, we would no doubt conclude that humans do not reproduce, do not form kinship groups, and devote their entire life cycle to the metamorphosis of the larval student into the adult professor. We might even suppose that professors exercise noticeable power in human society. A competent investigation would quickly reveal the inaccuracy of such conclusions. But in the case of the Pecaninos, no competent investigation is permitted or even contemplated. Anthropology is never an exact science. The observer never experiences the same culture as the participant. But these are natural limitations inherent in the science. It is the artificial limitations that hamper us, and through us, you. At the present rate of progress, we might as well be mailing questionnaires to the Pecaninos and waiting for them to dash off scholarly papers in reply. João Figueira Alvarez, reply to Pietro Guattanini of the University of Sicily, Milano Campus, Etruria. Published posthumously in Xenological Studies, 22-4-49-193.
The news of Pippo's death was not of merely local importance. It was transmitted instantaneously by Ansible to all the 100 worlds. The first aliens discovered since Ender's xenocide had tortured to death the one human who was designated to observe them. Within hours, scholars, scientists, politicians, and journalists began to strike their poses. A consensus soon emerged. One incident under baffling circumstances does not prove the failure of Starway's council policy toward the Piggies. On the contrary, the fact that only one man died seems to prove the wisdom of the present policy of near inaction. We should, therefore, do nothing except continue to observe at a slightly less intense pace. Pippo's successor was instructed to visit the Piggies no more often than every other day, and never for longer than an hour. He was not to push the Piggies to answer questions concerning their treatment of Pippo. It was a reinforcement of the old policy of inaction. There was also much concern about the morale of the people of Lusitania. They were sent many new entertainment programs by Ansible, despite the expense, to help take their minds off the grisly murder. And then, having done the little that could be done by Framlings, who were, after all, light years away from Lusitania, the people of the 100 worlds returned to their local concerns. Outside Lusitania, only one man among the half-trillion human beings in the 100 worlds felt the death of João Figueira Alvarez, called Pippo, as a great change in the shape of his own life. Andrew Wiggin was a speaker for the dead in the university city of Reykjavik, renowned as the conservator of Nordic culture, perched on the steep slopes of a knife-like fjord that pierced the granite and ice of the frozen world of Trondheim right at the equator. It was spring, so the snow was in retreat and fragile grass and flowers reached out for strength from the glistening sun. Andrew sat on the brow of a sunny hill, surrounded by a dozen students who were studying the history of interstellar colonization. Andrew was only half listening to a fiery argument over whether the utter human victory in the Bugger Wars had been a necessary prelude to human expansion. Such arguments always degenerated quickly into a vilification of the human monster Ender, who commanded the Starfleet that committed the xenocide of the Buggers. Andrew tended to let his mind wander somewhat. The subject did not exactly bore him, but he preferred not to let it engage his attention either. Then the small computer implant worn like a jewel in his ear told him of the cruel death of Pippo, the xenologer, on Lusitania, and instantly Andrew became alert. He interrupted his students. "What do you know of the Piggies?" he asked. "They are the only hope of our redemption," said one, who took Calvin rather more seriously than Luther. Andrew looked at once to the student, Plicht, who he knew would not be able to endure such mysticism. "They do not exist for any human purpose, not even redemption," said Plicht, with withering contempt. "They are true Raman, like the Buggers." Andrew nodded, but frowned. You use a word that is not yet common coin. It should be, said Pleakt. Everyone in Trondheim, every Nord in the Hundred Worlds, should have read Demosthenes' History of Wutan in Trondheim by now. We should, but we haven't, sighed a student. Make her stop strutting, speaker, said another. Pleakt is the only woman I know who can strut sitting down. Pleakt closed her eyes. The Nordic language recognizes four orders of foreignness. The first is the Otherlander, or Utlending, the stranger that we recognize as being a human of our world, but of another city or country. The second is the Fremling. Demosthenes merely drops the accent from the Nordic Fremling. This is the stranger that we recognize as human, but of another world. The third is the Raman, the stranger that we recognize as human, but of another species. The fourth is the true alien, the Varelsa, which includes all the animals, for with them no conversation is possible. They live, but we cannot guess what purposes or causes make them act. They might be intelligent, they might be self-aware, but we cannot know it. Andrew noticed that several students were annoyed. He called it to their attention. You think you're annoyed because of Pleakt's arrogance, but that isn't so. Pleakt is not arrogant. She is merely precise. You are properly ashamed that you have not yet read Demosthenes' History of Your Own People, and so in your shame, you are annoyed at Pleakt because she is not guilty of your sin. I thought speakers didn't believe in sin, said a sullen boy. Andrew smiled. You believe in sin, Stirka. And you do things because of that belief. So sin is real in you, and knowing you, this speaker must believe in sin. Stirka refused to be defeated. What does all this talk of Utlannings and Framlings and Ramen and Varelsa have to do with Ender's xenocide? Andrew turned to Pleakt. She thought for a moment. Well, this is relevant to the stupid argument that we were just having. Through these Nordic layers of foreignness, we can see that Ender was not a true xenocide, for when he destroyed the buggers, we knew them only as Varelsa. It was not until years later, when the original speaker for the dead wrote The Hive Queen and the Hegemon, that humankind first understood that the buggers were not Varelsa at all, but Ramen. Until that time, there had been no understanding between bugger and human. Xenocide is xenocide, said Stirka. Just because Ender didn't know they were Ramen doesn't make them any less dead. Andrew sighed at Stirka's unforgiving attitude. It was the fashion among Calvinists at Reykjavik to deny any weight to human motive in judging the good or evil of an act. Acts are good and evil in themselves, they said, and because speakers for the dead held as their only doctrine that good or evil exist entirely in human motive and not at all in the act, it made students like Stirka quite hostile to Andrew. Fortunately, Andrew did not resent it. He understood the motive behind it. Stirka, Pleakt, let me put you another case. Suppose that the piggies, who have learned to speak Stark, and whose languages some humans have also learned, suppose that we learned that they had suddenly, without provocation or explanation, tortured to death the xenologer sent to observe them. Pleakt jumped at the question immediately. How could we know it was without provocation? What seems innocent to us might be unbearable to them. Andrew smiled. Even so, but the xenologer has done them no harm, has said very little, has cost them nothing. By any standard we can think of, he is not worthy of painful death. Doesn't the very fact of this incomprehensible murder make the piggies Varelsa instead of Ramen? Now it was Stirka who spoke quickly. Murder is murder. This talk of Varelsa and Raman is nonsense. If the piggies murder, then they are evil, as the buggers were evil. If the act is evil, then the actor is evil. Andrew nodded. There is our dilemma. There's the problem. Was the act evil, or was it somehow, to the piggies' understanding, at least good? Are the piggies Raman or Varelsa? For the moment, Stirka, hold your tongue. I know all the arguments of your Calvinism, but even John Calvin would call your doctrine stupid. How do you know what Calvin would? Because he's dead, roared Andrew. And so I'm entitled to speak for him. The students laughed, and Stirka withdrew into stubborn silence. The boy was bright, Andrew knew. His Calvinism would not outlast his undergraduate education, though its excision would be long and painful. "Talmud speaker," said Pleaked, "you spoke as if your hypothetical situation were true, as if the piggies really had murdered the xenologer." Andrew nodded gravely. "Yes, it's true." It was disturbing. It awoke echoes of the ancient conflict between bugger and human. "Look in your cells at this moment," said Andrew. "You will find that underneath your hatred of Ender the Xenocide and your grief for the death of the buggers, you also feel something much uglier. You're afraid of the stranger, whether he's Utlanning or Framling. When you think of him killing a man that you know of and value, then it doesn't matter what his shape is. He's Varelsa, then, or worse, Jur, the dire beast that comes in the night with slavering jaws. If you had the only gun in your village and the beasts that had torn apart one of your people were coming again, would you stop to ask if they also had a right to live, or would you act to save your village, the people that you knew, the people who depended on you?" "By your argument, we should kill the piggies now, primitive and helpless as they are," shouted Styrka. "My argument? I asked a question. A question isn't an argument, unless you think you know my answer. And I assure you, Styrka, that you do not. Think about this. Class is dismissed." "Will we talk about this tomorrow?" they demanded. "If you want," said Andrew. But he knew that if they discussed it, it would be without him. For them, the issue of Ender the Xenocide was merely philosophical. After all, the Bugger Wars were more than 3,000 years ago. It was now the year 1948 SC, counting from the year the Starways Code was established. And Ender had destroyed the Buggers in the year 1180 BSC. But to Andrew, the events were not so remote. He had done far more interstellar travel than any of his students would dare to guess. Since he was 25, he had, until Trondheim, never stayed more than 6 months on any planet. Lightspeed travel between worlds had let him skip like a stone over the surface of time. His students had no idea that their speaker for the dead, who was surely no older than 35, had very clear memories of events 3,000 years before. That, in fact, those events seemed scarcely 20 years ago to him, only half his lifetime. They had no idea how deeply the question of Ender's ancient guilt burned within him, and how he had answered it in 1,000 different unsatisfactory ways. They knew their teacher only as speaker for the dead. They did not know that when he was a mere infant, his older sister, Valentine, could not pronounce the name Andrew, and so called him Ender, the name that he made infamous before he was 15 years old. So let unforgiving Styrka and analytical Plicht ponder the great question of Ender's guilt. For Andrew Wigan, speaker for the dead, the question was not academic. And now, walking along the damp grassy hillside in the chill air, Ender, Andrew, speaker, could think only of the piggies, who were already committing inexplicable murders, just as the buggers had carelessly done when they first visited humankind. Was it something unavoidable, when strangers met, that the meeting had to be marked with blood? The buggers had casually killed human beings, but only because they had a hive mind. To them, individual life was as precious as nail parings, and killing a human or two was simply their way of letting us know that they were in the neighborhood. Could the piggies have such a reason for killing, too? But the voice in his ear had spoken of torture, a ritual murder similar to the execution of one of the piggies' own. The piggies were not a hive mind. They were not the buggers. And Ender Wigan had to know why they had done what they did. "When did you hear about the death of the xenologer?" Ender turned. It was Pleaked. She had followed him instead of going back to the caves where the students lived. "Then, while we spoke," he touched his ear. Implanted terminals were expensive, but they were not all that rare. "I checked the news just before class. There was nothing about it then. If a major story had been coming in by Ansible, there would have been an alert, unless you got the news straight from the Ansible report." Pleaked obviously thought she had a mystery on her hands, and in fact she did. "Speakers have high priority access to public information," he said. Has someone asked you to speak the death of the Xenologer? He shook his head. Lusitania is under a Catholic license. That's what I mean, she said. They won't have a speaker of their own there, but they still have to let a speaker come if someone requests it, and Trondheim is the closest world to Lusitania. Nobody's called for a speaker. Pleakt tugged at his sleeve. Why are you here? You know why I came. I spoke the death of Wutan. I know you came here with your sister, Valentine. She's a much more popular teacher than you are. She answers questions with answers. You just answer with more questions. That's because she knows some answers. Speaker, you have to tell me. I tried to find out about you. I was curious. Your name, for one thing. Where you came from. Everything's classified. Classified so deep that I can't even find out what the access level is. God himself couldn't look up your life story. Ender took her by the shoulders, looked down into her eyes. It's none of your business. That's what the access level is. You are more important than anybody guesses, Speaker, she said. The Ansible reports to you before it reports to anybody, doesn't it? And nobody can look up information about you. Nobody has ever tried. Why you? I want to be a speaker, she said. Go ahead, then. The computer will train you. It isn't like a religion. You don't have to memorize any catechism. Now leave me alone. He let go of her with a little shove. She staggered backward as he strode off. I want to speak for you, she cried. I'm not dead yet, he shouted back. I know you're going to Lusitania. I know you are. Then you know more than I do, said Ender silently. But he trembled as he walked, even though the sun was shining, and he wore three sweaters to keep out the cold. He hadn't known Pleakt had so much emotion in her. Obviously, she had come to identify with him. It frightened him to have this girl need something from him so desperately. He had spent years now without making any real connection with anyone but his sister Valentine, her and, of course, the dead that he spoke. All the other people who had meant anything to him in his life were dead. He and Valentine had passed them by centuries ago, worlds ago. The idea of casting a root into the icy soil of Trondheim repelled him. What did Pleakt want from him? It didn't matter. He wouldn't give it. How dare she demand things from him as if he belonged to her? Ender Wiggin didn't belong to anybody. If she knew who he really was, she would loathe him as the Xenocide. Or she would worship him as the savior of mankind. Ender remembered what it was like when people used to do that, too, and he didn't like it much. Even now, they knew him only by his role. By the name, Speaker, Talman, Volante, Spieler. Whatever they called the speaker for the dead in the language of their city or nation or world. He didn't want them to know him. He did not belong to them, to the human race. He had another errand. He belonged to someone else. Not human beings, not the bloody piggies either. Or so he thought.